Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 30th of June, these are our main stories. The World Health Organization has warned that the coronavirus pandemic is still accelerating and the worst may yet be to come. The US Supreme Court has struck down a controversial abortion law in a ruling the White House has called unfortunate. And the US Secretary of State has called on China to immediately end its reported sterilization of women from the Muslim Uyghur community. Also in this podcast,
I was given an anonymous tip-off of basically a link and a code to get into the hackers' website. They operate on the dark web.
We enter a murky world and hear about cyber blackmail against COVID-19 researchers. The head of the World Health Organization has warned that the coronavirus pandemic isn't even close to being over. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that despite progress in some countries, the pandemic was speeding up.
Most people remain susceptible. The virus still has a lot of room to move. We all want this to be over. We all want to get on with our lives. But the hard reality is, this is not even close to being over. Although many countries have made some progress, globally, the pandemic is actually speeding up.
I asked our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folkes, did he have anywhere particular in mind?
I think he's probably referring particularly to the Americas. He mentioned that you know, more than half of all new cases are coming from North and South America. And he was blunter than he often is, Dr. Tedros, today. He said it's time to get our act together and put politics aside, and that basically the only way, given that we have no vaccine and we will not have one this year, we can be sure of that, is distancing, hygiene, tracing cases, isolating contacts. And I think, you know, we all know it. There have been political debates in North America and in South America, in Brazil in particular, about what you should do about this. And I think the World Health Organization is trying to say, look, don't argue about politics right now. Get on with the stuff that we know works. Your population may find it frustrating, but it's better than having this virus rampage through the community.
As you say, we do know the advice, don't we? It's about social distancing, it's about masks, it's about hand washing, all of those things. Did you get the impression that he's beginning to sound a little exasperated that he has to keep repeating this message?
Do you know, I think the World Health Organization would really love to be able to offer the world's population a bit more hope. I mean, you know, you're sitting in a fairly privileged country, I'm sitting in a fairly privileged country, but we're all fed up with it, aren't we? We're fed up with having to work from home, fed up with having to keep our distance, not being able to give our friends a hug, not being able to feel really comfortable in a restaurant or in a pub. And also witnessing here in Europe, as soon as there are a few relaxations, the cases start popping up again. We're all tired of that. And unfortunately, what the World Health Organization had to tell us today was, but you're going to have to do it for longer.
In the United States, the White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany has said that President Trump believes the wearing of face masks to halt the spread of coronavirus is a personal decision.
I talked to the president before coming out here. It's his choice to wear a mask. It's the personal choice of any individual as to whether to wear a mask or not. He encourages people to make whatever decision is best for their safety. But he did say to me he has no problem with masks and to do whatever your local jurisdiction requests of you.
Mr. Trump has been coming under growing pressure over the wearing of masks as the number of infections in the U.S. increases. He himself has not been seen publicly wearing one, saying he couldn't picture himself doing so while greeting foreign leaders, and he didn't want to give journalists the pleasure of seeing him in one. In the U.S., there have so far been nearly 129,000 deaths related to COVID-19. Experts say there's a simple thing people in the country could do to save thousands of lives, but many people don't want to do it. Here's Will Chalk.
Meet Butch.
My name is Butch, and I'm an American patriot.
He really likes being American.
See that flag? I would die for that!
What he doesn't like is being told he has to wear a face mask. And he's not alone.
They want to throw God's wonderful breathing system out the door.
Last week, people in Florida were asked to give their views on whether face masks should be compulsory. Butch was just the tip of the iceberg.
It is appalling to muffle people, to put masks on our face, to keep us from breathing oxygen, to get us to become sickly.
We will get together and do a citizen's arrest on every single human being that goes against the freedom of choice. You literally cannot mandate somebody to wear a mask.
You see, things in some parts of America have taken
a very swift and very dangerous turn.
That's the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott.
In Texas, the daily number of cases have gone from an average of about 2,000 to more than 5,000 per day.
It's one of a number of southern and western states that's dealing with a spike in cases. The number of daily cases in the US generally have been declining in May and early June, but has risen since lockdown restrictions were eased. Some places have had to tighten up again to bring down infection rates and stop hospitals becoming full up with people who fall ill. Over in California, bars that had opened up again have been told to re-shut. Lucas runs the Tin Horn Flats Grill.
I don't feel as if that is fair. I feel like it's against our constitution right now because we have guys that need jobs.
But the big thing that those in power are pushing for is for people to
wear a mask.
More than a dozen states have voted to make people wear them.
Now, breaking news from CBS 17 News.
Just a few hours, face covering is going to be required across North Carolina. All the schools.
But protesters claim it's a violation of their rights. These guys in North Carolina walked into a government building and started singing the national anthem, not wearing masks, obviously. We're free people, demonstrators argue. You shouldn't be able to force us to wear anything. But then the messages from the top have hardly been consistent. Take a listen to Donald Trump back in May.
Well, I just don't want to wear one myself. It's a recommendation. They recommend it. I won't be doing it personally.
Although Vice President Mike Pence says people should follow local laws requiring them to wear one.
We encourage everyone to wear a mask.
The US Vice President Mike Pence ending that report by Will Chalk. A state of emergency has been declared in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia, following a surge in the number of COVID-19 cases. A decree issued by the local governor gives the capital access to extra funds. Public and private hospitals in Brasilia are operating close to full capacity. Chile is also being badly hit by COVID-19. Tim Franks spoke to Paula Molina, a journalist and radio presenter in the capital, Santiago.
In many ways, Chile faces the same dilemma as the rest of Latin America and the world, maybe, how to reduce infections without completely stopping its economy. But some aspects have aggravated the crisis, I think. First, an enormous level of inequality. There's also a deep disconnection between the elite and the rest of the country. There's been a very confusing communication from the government about the number of infected people and the risks posed by the pandemic in Chile. So we don't know if the country has reached the peak of its contagions and death, and we are heading into a winter and could be extremely somber and sad.
Do you get a sense of how people are themselves feeling about the course of the disease? Because clearly, I mean, you know, a lot of people in Latin America, they work in the informal sector, they live pretty much hand to mouth, they have to go out to find work, they have to go out to buy food, and to do so pretty much daily. Is there a sense that, people are just thinking, well, we may be concerned about the disease, but we can't really alter our behaviour?
Well, that's very interesting. Actually, some research that we have from organisations working with the poorest among the poor, people are very concerned and they are taking as much measures as they can. But as you say, they just can't afford to stay at home. But also, there's been a number of businesses who are still open, who are like trying to find ways to not to follow the rules. And that is also playing a part in this Chilean crisis.
Journalist Paola Molina in Chile. The British government has imposed the UK's first localised lockdown in the city of Leicester in the English Midlands because of a spike in coronavirus cases there. The announcement was made by the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. Palab Ghosh has more details.
Mr Hancock told MPs that 10% of positive coronavirus cases detected across the country in the past week were in Leicester. The message to people in the city was that they should now stay at home as much as possible. Schools and non-essential shops there will close, and the government is advising against all but essential travel to or from the city. Restrictions include the surrounding area of Oadby, Birstall and Glenfield and will be reviewed in 2 weeks' time. More testing facilities will be provided, with a walk-in centre set up for anyone with symptoms.
That was Palab Ghosh. Doctors around the world are now beginning to understand the long-term effects of COVID-19 among patients who've recovered from the condition. Among them is the 74-year-old British children's author, Michael Rosen. He fell ill in March and spent the best part of 7 weeks in an induced coma on a ventilator. He's now back at home. Michelle Hussein spoke to Michael Rosen and began by asking, how is he?
The first word I think of to describe myself is feeble. My legs feel very, very feeble. I sort of think of them as cardboard tubes full of porridge. That when I ask them to do things, they don't do it. So I've learnt how to walk with a stick and a bit without a stick. I can hear that my voice is a bit feeble as well. And then I get tired very quickly. So generally, it's a sort of sense of feebleness. I've also lost some sight from my left eye and from my left ear. So I feel a bit sort of lopsided. So there we are, feeble and lopsided.
You got ill in March. Do you remember the point where you realised what was happening to you was really serious?
I don't think I did. I thought I was coping with a flu in the way that we do, or that it was the coronavirus and I was going to be one of those people who would experience it as a kind of flu. And it was only when things started moving very, very quickly, because Emma and our friend, a GP who's just a neighbour, did the oxygen saturation test on me. And suddenly there was a kind of, I won't say a panic, but you've got to go into A&E now. And then suddenly things started buzzing all around me. But I don't think I sensed at that moment that I was probably 2 or 3 hours off departing this planet.
Would you think it was that touch and go at that time?
Yes, because my respiratory system was conking out, but also so was my liver and kidneys. And I didn't know that, but found out afterwards.
Emma, your wife is sitting next to you now. What do you remember of that time? Was it absolutely clear to you just how serious things were?
The doctor told me that he may have to be put on a ventilator that night. My daughter and I came home and we didn't really sleep that night, so We did think that Michael might go that night. He carried on for another 8 days on the ward on a CPAP mask, but then became increasingly tired and then was readmitted to intensive care.
Well, I have a memory of somebody saying that we can put you on a ventilator. They handed me a piece of paper and said, you've got a 50-50 chance. And I said, well, are you telling me that's better than the chance I've got now? And I said, are you saying that I might not wake up? And they said, yes. And then I signed something. But I think I was a bit light-headed. But I remember thinking, oh, well, 50-50 chance. I was quite sort of flippant about it, really, to myself.
I think he was on the ventilator then for the best part of 7 weeks.
It's extraordinary just to hear that, a ventilator for 7 weeks, and then they started to bring you out of it, Michael. What is the first thing you remember when you came out of it?
I've got little patches of memory. I can see some doctors standing round me arguing about which would be the best oxygen mask to have. I remember waking up one night and asking the nurses where I was. I didn't really know. And in fact, I didn't know about the 7 weeks being in this induced coma until I came home and Emma told me about it. So it's actually quite recent. I got quite upset about it, actually. I had no idea that I was in this induced coma for that long, and that I just have this picture of Emma and our children and wider family and so on, just on the edge, not knowing whether I was going to survive or not.
The children's author, Michael Rosen, speaking to Michelle Hussein. Still to come.
As well as the re-education policy, the Chinese authorities are also engaged in what he says is forced sterilizations and forcing women to use contraceptive devices.
Claims that China is trying to limit the population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. One of the most notorious serial killers in US criminal history has pleaded guilty to dozens of charges of murder, rape, and burglary across California in the 1970s and 80s. Joseph James DeAngelo, a former police officer who became known as the Golden State Killer, taunted the authorities for many years, bragging about former crimes as well as those he was planning. He was finally caught in 2018 on the basis of DNA evidence. Our correspondent Peter Bowes in Los Angeles told us about this macabre case.
It's a case that had been frustrating investigators really for decades. A series, as you describe, rapes and murders across California between 1974 and mid-1986. And the details are really extraordinary and quite gruesome. In the early years, this is in Sacramento in Northern California, there was a theme to the crimes. And armed and masked rapists would break into couples' homes at night while they were sleeping. He would tie up the man, sometimes stack some plates from the kitchen on his back, and he would threaten to kill both of them, the man and the woman, if he heard the plates falling while he was raping the woman. There was attack after attack, month after month, for a period of time in 1976. It really was a community paralysed by fear. Everyone had heard about this man who seemed to keep on getting away with his crimes. He would wear a ski mask. He would sometimes have a gun. He would, as you said, taunt the police and the media covering these attacks. He would take mementos from people's homes, photographs, jewellery. He sometimes lingered in the house. He would eat or drink from the refrigerator. And as the years passed, investigators did eventually connect these assaults in Central and Northern California with a series of murders in Southern California, at least 13 murders, and that's when he became known as the Golden State Killer.
And he was caught eventually through DNA evidence. How did that happen?
Yeah, the link between the cases in the northern part of the state and Southern California was established because of advances in DNA evidence in technology in 2001. An arrest was made in 2008. The authorities used DNA to track him through a genealogy website, and they found some distant relatives of the man that we now know to be Joseph James DeAngelo Jr., age 74. Now they managed to get some DNA from him through items that he'd thrown away outside his house. And his eventual arrest came as a shock to his neighbours. They knew him as the guy on the street who had a meticulously manicured lawn. He'd been working in a supermarket distribution centre, and before that, as a police officer.
That was Peter Bowes in Los Angeles, and we stay in the United States.
I'm very disappointed, and I believe that this is a huge loss for the women of Louisiana and for the women of this country.
A disappointed anti-abortion campaigner after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a law in the conservative state of Louisiana, which made it harder for doctors to work at abortion clinics in the state. Abortion is one of the cultural fault lines in the United States, and some conservatives have been hoping that the Supreme Court, with two new judges named by President Trump, would take a stand against it. But not so far. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington told us more.
It means that the status quo is maintained. So the services that are being provided now in Louisiana and elsewhere, because of course the Supreme Court takes decisions that impact over time nationally the situation, women have the right to abortion that should not be restricted in an undue way. The law says there should not be an undue burden on women's right to abortion. So although states can restrict it, that requirement means that laws like this Louisiana one was struck down.
And of course, this is just about Louisiana, but it's part of a huge, much broader ongoing struggle, isn't it?
And also one that has reached a particular phase, because this is the first major abortion case that was heard by the Supreme Court since President Trump appointed two conservative judges to the bench, which essentially has shifted the court rightward. And this is why it was so closely watched. But what happened in the end is that the conservative Chief Justice decided to strike down the law because he said a nearly identical one had been struck down 4 years ago in Texas. And he said that that was a precedent. So he was basically making a decision to uphold what he saw as the rule of law, a precedent.
The people who want to restrict abortion, to end abortion, aren't going to be giving up at this point, though, are they?
No, they aren't. And there has been a wave of restrictions passed by state legislators that are now tied up in the lower courts, and they will continue to try to fight them there and get those cases to the Supreme Court in certain situations. I think if the Supreme Court had voted to uphold the Louisiana law, that probably would have given momentum to this process that is not necessarily going to be there now. But it is also, I should say, a disappointment to the Trump White House, because President Trump has positioned himself as an advocate of anti-abortion advocates. And he has put the White House has put out a statement just now saying that it was an unfortunate ruling and the Supreme Court has devalued both the health of mothers and the lives of unborn children.
That was Barbara Platt-Usher. The first test flight of the re-equipped Boeing 737 MAX aircraft has taken off from Seattle's King County Airport. The planes have been grounded since March last year after two fatal crashes. Theo Leggett reports.
These tests are a major milestone in Boeing's efforts to get the 737 MAX back into service. Carried out by FAA pilots, they'll evaluate key systems, including a revised version of the flight control software which was implicated in the two accidents. The original system is believed to have overridden the pilots' commands and forced both aircraft into catastrophic dives. No decision has yet been taken as to when the plane can return to commercial flight.
That was Theo Leggett. China has long been under scrutiny for its policies towards Muslim Uyghurs, not least for its practice of detaining up to 1 million Uyghur people in what it says are re-education camps. Research now suggests that China is trying to limit the population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. Our South Asia editor Michael Bristow told us what's been unearthed.
What this researcher has done now, his name is Adrian Zenz, he's a German, and he's done a lot of research into Xinjiang. What he's found now is that as well as the re-education policy, the Chinese authorities are also engaged in what he says is forced sterilizations and forcing women to use contraceptive devices in order, as he says, to limit the population of Uyghur Muslims. He's found all this out by essentially trawling through publicly available data. It's all on the internet about population figures, the use of contraceptives, of sterilizations. And he's found the population of minorities in Xinjiang, particularly Uyghurs, has just plummeted. The growth rate has plummeted over recent years because of these actions by the Chinese government.
Now, the use of contraceptive devices is one thing, but the forced use is something else. So how reliable is his evidence that women are being forced into this?
It's very difficult to find out any information about Xinjiang because China doesn't allow independent journalists or human rights supporters or defenders or the United Nations to travel there and independently verify all of this information. And China has already said that these accusations are baseless. It's very difficult to establish whether or not something is being done by force or because people have requested it. Anecdotally, though, there is a lot of evidence from women in Xinjiang of saying they've been forced to undergo sterilizations and have these contraceptive devices fitted. Also, there's reports of women in re-education camps who have been forced to take tablets, which has affected their menstrual cycles. And so there's a lot of anecdotal evidence as well as statistical evidence to back up these claims. At the very least, there appears to be a question to answer. And that's indeed what lots of people are already saying. The one international parliamentary group is already saying this is worthy of further research.
Michael Bristow. Now, time to enter the world of the dark web, sort of. A leading medical research institution working on a cure for COVID-19 has admitted it paid hackers more than $1 million ransom after a covert negotiation. Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy, was given access to watch this negotiation happen.
Well, I was given an anonymous tip-off of basically a link and a code to get into the hackers' website. They operate on the dark web, which they use to extort their victims. It's a place where you go to essentially pay the ransom that these cyber criminals are asking for and open up a negotiation. And over the course of a week, I watched the negotiation take place. I didn't obviously contribute to the chat or anything. I just observed and recorded what I saw. And it was infuriating to watch, to be honest with you. It was watching these criminals extort this university, which is already cash-strapped because of the pandemic. They said in the chat, please, you know, go easy on us. We are spending all our money and energy trying to come up with a cure for COVID-19. But the hackers said, we don't care about that. At one point, they were saying the most we can give you is $780,000. And the hackers said, that's nothing for us. I'm taking this as an insult. You can keep that money and buy your staff McDonald's with it. This is a sort of infuriating thing that you see when you're witnessing how these hackers operate.
So just how common is this sort of thing? And do companies generally pay up?
Very, very common. We know this is happening all the time because whenever we hear about a cyber attack these days, it's probably more than likely that it's ransomware. This is the form of a cyber attack where hackers gain entry to a system and they encrypt all the data and they say to the company or organization or government institution, whatever it is, they say, we have your encryption key here, pay us this money or you're not going to get your data back. So this is a really prevalent form of attack. We're seeing it all over the world all the time. These negotiations are happening behind closed doors on the dark web, in secret forums. The companies don't want to admit that they're paying because, of course, that implies perhaps that the security wasn't as good as it should have been or actually that they are contributing to a criminal enterprise. The FBI, NCSC in the UK, Europol across Europe, all these law enforcement agencies say, please don't pay these criminals because what you're doing is you're lining their pockets to give them bigger budgets to attack bigger targets.
And just finally, how can companies tackle something like this? How can the authorities tackle something like this?
Well, it's very hard to secure yourself completely from any cyber attack. It's almost impossible. In fact, if they want to find a way in, the chances are they will get in. But with ransomware, it's a funny thing because there is actually a really simple thing. Well, not simple, but it's one silver bullet, if you like, which will stop you from being, you know, completely at the whim of these hackers. And that is to back up your data. So it means that having, you know, all your patient records or research that you're using at the university, for example, if you have that in cold storage, they call it, so off the internet, then they can take it all they want. They can encrypt it all they want, but you've got backups.
You heard the man. Back up. Back up. That was Joe Tidy. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you know what to do. Send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye. Oh, actually, there's one more thing.
The Global News podcast has been nominated for an award, and we need your help and your votes if we're to win. The Listener's Choice Award recognises the best UK podcast as voted for by its fans. To cast your vote, head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Search Global News Podcast in the search bar. Enter your name and email address to verify your details. Press submit and you'll receive an email back. Just hit confirm and that's it. You voted. The deadline for voting is 12 noon BST on the 6th of July. Just head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and choose the Global News Podcast.
Thank you.